Number two, this is the open public input. I think most of you are familiar with how the process works. I'll call you up two at a time. You sit and then talk in front of the mic, please. And it's a three-minute limit. You'll hear a buzzer go off, and that means you bring your thoughts to a conclusion. The only exception is for elected officials. We do not have the three-minute time limit. So with that, I'm going to call you up, Don Jackson and Jim Peterson, please.
Yeah, can you find out?
Right.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. Is this close enough, about right?
That's good.
Okay. My name is Don Jackson. I live in the little town of Starbuck. I have a ranch there on the Toucannon River. The Toucannon runs through my place for, a little over a mile, I guess. And up till 2013, the Toucannon River, according to the department, our fish, the number of fish caught, was the best in the state of Washington. I mean, that's quite an honor to have. And then in 2010, the department, whoever, decided to stop planting any fish in the Toucannon. And up until 2013, we were catching 1,800 steelhead a year in the Toucannon, right at that. After they stopped planting them a year ago, they caught 13. That's not 1,300. That went from 1,800 down to 13. You know, if I went into the bank and asked for an operating loan with a figure like that, that'd end my career with the bank right there. I mean, that's not very impressive. I usually had about 25 people, 30 people fish on my place every year. Our place has been in the family 100 years. It's always been open to hunting and fishing. It's never been closed. 2 years ago, one guy came back and fished. Last year, there was not one person fished on my place. Not one. When they started this program of doing away with the hatchery fish in 2010, they wanted to eliminate the hatchery fish because in some way they were causing a problem with the wild fish. You've had a hatchery on the Toucannon River. The department has maintained a hatchery since 1949. That's 68 years that we've been putting hatchery fish in the Toucannon. But all at once, they're hurting the wild fish. And I don't understand how that all works. I don't think the guys doing it understand it either, what's going on. They say hatchery fish are bad. People don't like to catch them. You have those lakes on the Toucannon River, up on the Wooten Game Range, and you plant hatchery steelhead in those ponds, those lakes, and thousands of people come up there to catch those hatchery fish. So somebody likes to catch hatchery fish. I know I do. I was at a meeting the other day where one of your biologists told us it's going to take at least 50 years to get the Toucannon fishery back. I'm on the Salmon Recovery Board there, and we're spending $2 million a year on the Toucannon. If it's going to take 50 years, that's $100 million to get a few fish back in our river. If that buzzer goes off, you tell me, because last time I missed it. You let me know. You know, I asked one of our...
Well, I'll go like this, too.
All right, you do that. I attended a meeting there last winter, one of your biologists was there, and I asked him, I said, will I ever be able to take my grandkids out on my place and fish for steelhead again in my lifetime? He said, no, you never will. I mean, if they're talking about 50 years. If we wait 50 years, I'll be 128 years old, and I probably won't be doing much fishing then. But I'm worried about this for my grandkids. I've caught enough steelhead. If I never catch another one, so what? But my kids and my grandkids ought to have the same opportunity that I did.
Thank you.
I don't know what you can do to help us on this, but anything you can do will be deeply appreciated by me and by my kids and grandkids. And thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. It's always a pleasure to listen to you. Thank
you. And before I forget, I talked to you people in Vancouver a year ago about the coyotes killing my calves and all the trouble we was having. Well, thanks to Steve Fazanga, we pretty well got our problem worked out, and I just wanted to say publicly thank you to him.
Thank you.
They brought a helicopter on my place for 1 hour, and they killed 17 coyotes right out in the middle of my cows. They flew down to El Topo that afternoon, they killed 93.
Wow.
So thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Mr. Peterson, and then after you're done, I'm going to call up two county commissioners.
Yes. Okay, thank you. This is a scary position to hear to talk to you folks. I'm Jim Peterson. I live at 1242 Cannon Road. Don and I are kind of neighbors. He's about eight miles downriver. We didn't get together to decide what we're going to talk about, so I may repeat what issues he had. But I've lived and hunted in the Blue Mountains for over 50 years, and for about 18 years, my wife and I have owned a farm right on the Toucannon River. We owned a half a mile of the river. We've got a waterfall that goes completely across the river. It drops about 4 to 5 feet there, and I used to see fish jumping those falls. And when I first moved there, I'd count them, and I'd see an attempt at the falls one every 20 seconds. Now I don't. I just don't see any fish at all. Now, it's been with great heartbreak and, frankly, increasing anger that we've watched the gradual and predicted destruction of the steelhead fishing. I have the fish and wildlife data that clearly shows that fish do come to the dams, and once they get to one, they go over the other. But the important graph is here, and this shows that this was provided by Fish and Wildlife folks. Joe Baumgartner's the primary source of the data, and it's valid stuff, and it shows the precipitous decline that he has shown. At the same time, we've got a body of graphs that show that this decline in the river has been directly correlated with the lack of fish planted by the hatcheries, from the hatcheries. Well, the good news is that the Department of Fish and Wildlife is aware of the problem. They're working on it. And so what we really need now is a thrust to make sure that their support for the fish hatchery at Lions Ferry is maintained. Now, I've got a copy of a letter that was sent to Julie Collins, signed by about 16 of our local legislators. They, too, see the issue. So I guess my 3 minutes is not going to be used up. If you got questions, please ask me. But my concern is, folks, we've had a serious decline. The Toucannon clearly shows what happens if we don't provide the hatchery fish. We're going to destroy our fisheries. There are a lot of causes of what we can do to mitigate attempts, but the Salmon Recovery Board will declare that the river has been cleaner. It's colder than it ever is, but we built a hotel for nobody to come to. We need those fish. And that source, our feedstock, is the hatcheries. So whatever you can do, it's just been extremely painful to watch the decline of that magnificent river. And we used to have a superior steelhead fishery. We don't. And I just ask you to aggressively help restore that segment of our cherished wildlife.
Thank you, sir. I think both your comments, the two of you,
thank you.
Take that. And I'm going to call up Commissioner Shin and Commissioner Dixon, please. In that order.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind.
Okay.
So we have three local electeds with us this morning, and we have Representative Mary Dye here as well, and I would ask Mary to come up as well.
Oh, okay.
We're throwing curves at it, right?
Yeah, I know. You guys all are plotting here? Please.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. It's an honor to be here, and I have been working on fish and wildlife issues for the last year, and now it's a great honor to have an opportunity to actually see the people that I'm serving face to face, and it's been a privilege to work on these issues, starting with the fish issues and the Toucannon. And that was kind of my inroad into the work that you guys do. And having met some of the members of the the people that have done the stream habitat restoration projects, and seeing how the hatchery program has evolved to try and restore the hatchery, to restore the wild genetic stock, and how dramatic an impact that has. We were able, with the work of Raquel Crozier and others, to identify about 13 action items, of which they have really initiated about 7 of those. And it's a more comprehensive approach to try and deal with all of the impacts and the changes that occurred when we eliminated the domestic stock out of that hatchery program at Lions Ferry. We're working on trying to find federal funding for getting smaller rearing tanks at that hatchery so that we can be more programmatic in that area. We're looking at the changes in the spawn date for that genetic stock, and how closing the fish ladders at Lower Granite Dam traps a lot of those fish upstream inadvertently because of the maintenance program being untimely for the new genetic stock. So I think there's a lot of work that we can do to try and enhance the opportunities of restoring that stock on a quicker timetable. And I hope that in work with you guys and working through that list of items that we identified last winter, we can be successful in getting a successful restoration. Moving a fish hatchery program from 2 million smolts down to 50,000 has to be a dramatic impact. And of all the concerns that I have so far in seeing how we've moved forward, the biggest concern I have is the amount of spill and whether or not the department is looking at that impact, whether that quantity of spill is actually negatively impacting the smolts moving downstream, and if we need to be more thoughtful about how much water and how much oxygen and nitrification might be occurring in that. So those are some of the things that I brought to Raquel last week or the week before, and I hope that we can continue to be thoughtful about restoring that stock back to a fishable quantity and not lose that spring Chinook on the toucanon. The most recent thing that I've been working on is the elk herd at Cloverland. And, back to the fish, one other thing, the endorsement, the $8 endorsement for that. We crafted a piece of legislation, and we're unsuccessful in moving that forward. It got combined into the omnibus bill, and it's still stuck. So if you're wanting to deal with the fishing licenses, I would strongly suggest that, and the endorsement for the steelhead, I would strongly suggest that you give us a little bit of a hand in special too to get that done. Otherwise, that endorsement will probably faint this year. And I don't think that would be helpful for the restoration of this very fragile reintroduction of wild genetic stock in the toucanon. And then the other piece is the elk herd at Cloverland. And we have had a really helpful meeting with the department, and we identified the impact, the large impact that elk herd is having in the winter on the Cloverland crops. And so we have, Senator Schessler has constructed a couple of provisos, and I've constructed one in order to deal with some of the problem items that we identified. And we're working closely with Raquel Crozier and the department in making sure that it works with their programs. So I've taken a first draft, and we'll continue those conversations about the possibility of a feeding program at the Cloverland elk herd in the winter to try and lure them off of the farmland as the snow comes to the game department's land first and then moves down. So I would encourage you guys to put input into that. It's a very rough first draft, and would encourage you guys to look at it and make changes as you see as important and necessary to get that Cloverland herd from really doing extreme devastation to the local farming community. And finally, it's been a great opportunity to work with you again, and I'm enjoying this work very much. It's right in my wheelhouse. These are the types of issues that I've spent many, many years contemplating over the years of farming with my husband, and I just appreciate all the work that you and the commission do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate it. get your thoughts.
Thank you. Mary, thank you for the work you're doing on behalf of the natural resources in your wheelhouse and ours too. Director Unsworth, board members of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Mr. Chair, I'm Assotin County Commissioner Brian Shin, and on behalf of my fellow commissioners, Jim Jeffords and Chris Subert, as well as the citizens of Assotin County, we welcome you here to Assotin County. We're glad you're here. Thank you for holding the meeting here. I don't know if you know, but if you've ever seen any of Assotin County's material, it says Cornerstone County. And I think that's important. Cornerstones are generally a key part of the foundations upon which something is built. With our Assotin Lands Committee, we feel like we're part of what could be a new and more effective method for the department to reach its wildlife management goals. In 2014, former Director Phil Anderson, Eastern Region Director Steve Pizangra, new Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Jay Holzmiller, and I all met in a restaurant right down the hallway here. The department was getting a lot of negative feedback from throughout the state due to land purchases it was making, sometimes with department funds, sometimes with monies from conservation advocacy groups. These purchases, such as the 4-0 Land and Cattle Company purchase here in Assotin County, were designed to help the department to meet the wildlife goals you set up as a board. Well, since PILT, payment in lieu of taxes, has been frozen to 2009 levels, counties across the state have been losing money because of these purchases. I hope my voice holds out. I don't know what it is, but it's going. Any property purchased after that date didn't even contribute to counties at the artificially low open space rate. That doesn't take into account the huge numbers in personal property taxes lost. Well, what did the counties do? We had to spread the increased cost over the other property owners, the citizens. Director Anderson shared that he wanted to make Assotin County a pilot project, a cornerstone of new management ideas which could be applied throughout the state as we learn what works and what doesn't work to reach wildlife goals. Together, we assembled local landowners and department staff into the Assotin Lands Committee. Our charge was to come up with ways to meet department goals without the department buying more land and taking it off the tax rolls. Director Anderson promised this committee that the department would make no more purchases in Assotin County without coming first to the Board of Commissioners and to the Lands Committee. Director Unsworth, who I'm glad is here today, he attended one of our meetings when he first came on board, and he reaffirmed that pledge. At 9:30 this morning, you're scheduled to consider land purchases not in Assotin County. I don't know anything about these purchases except their general location. I just would like the commission to consider what we're trying to do in Assotin County through joint efforts of the department and the committee and the landowners. Tomorrow, you've got the opportunity to go on a lands tour in Assotin County. Hopefully, you'll see some of the test programs put in place to more effectively manage department lands through leasing out some properties for grazing and ag opportunities by local landowners. An earlier tour in 2014 with Director Anderson and department staff, along with Senator Schessler and committee members, pointed out the very stark differences between the management of department lands and private lands located side by side. Fencing department land and doing nothing with them is not land management. That might be a bit of an exaggeration in some, but not in all cases. Here's the good news. Through hard work by Eastern Region Director Steve Pizangra and his many local and regional staff, we now have an up-to-date inventory of department-owned lands in Assotin County with all the relevant information, such as what money purchased that land and what requirements does the funding place on that land usage. The staff then met with committee members and came up with ways to allow local farmers and ranchers on department lands, and they're able to generate local dollars, all while improving the land and making it a more effective part of our ecosystem. Nobody knows better than the department staff how much its budget has been cut in recent years. One of the biggest cuts is the money for staff and resources to manage already owned department lands. I understand that if an organization or trust is offering you money to buy land, your lack of management, it's hard to say no. You take that money. But if you have no money to properly manage that land, your lack of management is going to impact your private property neighbors. What you do affects them, and it negatively impacts wildlife management and agribusiness. Grazing cows on department land sets it up perfectly for deer and elk grazing. Anatone and Cloverland area farmers are suffering record wildlife damage to their crops right now. Department mitigation efforts are being made, but they're not enough, and they're not quite effective enough. You need more funding to mitigate the damages to growers, and we all need more ways to redirect the elk and deer. As a committee, we spend a lot of time looking for answers right along with department staff. Together, the Assiniboine Lands Committee and the department are making some inroads into improving department management of their lands in Assiniboine County. We are currently looking at more test projects where private usage of department lands enriches everyone. But we in Assiniboine County would like the department to reconsider purchasing more land, taking more property off the tax rolls statewide. We greatly appreciate the department's efforts to restore PILT, and it looks like the budget could restore a small amount of that. Thank you for your efforts to include PILT restoration in your budget request. You've done it repeatedly, and we genuinely appreciate that. But wouldn't it make more sense to concentrate your efforts to increase management activity on lands you already have instead of buying more lands? We at the county level will help you lobby for more money to help manage what you already have. I apologize, I'm using this as a chance to wet my whistle. We realize you're doing a lot with very little. Let's focus on management funding, not land purchases. We are looking forward to continuing work with the Assiniboine Lands Committee and the department working together. We're counting on your cooperation. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any comments?
Yes. I have a question. Thank you very much, Commissioner, for your comments. I'm an appreciative user of public lands. Most of your comments related to sort of the traditional rural uses of land. And one of the things that I puzzle about and am interested in is how recreational uses, the traditional sportsman, hunting, fishing, but also those watchable wildlife, hiking, camping, those kinds of things, could enhance the local communities. Is that the kind of discussion, does that enter the discussion of your lands committee?
Oh, I think it does a lot. In fact, at our last meeting, I believe Steve Pizangra brought up some numbers on that. Some staff prepared some because we as committee members asked them to calculate the amount of money spent in Assiniboine County from tourism. We know we are a tourist mecca. This is God's country. You just talked about being mesmerized by the river out there. And a lot of people have moved to Assiniboine County in the valley because they love these recreational opportunities, from hunting to fishing to bird watching. Bird watching is a booming hobby around this neck of the woods. I just moved recently on the edge of the river, and there's eagles that come in and land on an old snag out on the core property. So we are aware of that, and we realize that value. I'm sorry.
That means you have to buy donuts. Yeah.
What did you say, Mr. Chair?
Yes. We have a rule on the commission: if somebody's phone goes off, they have to buy donuts for everybody.
Okay.
Next time we come, you're up.
Sorry about that.
Well, Jay said he'll do it for you.
Thank you. Did I address your question?
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in what we as the commission can be doing to promote this for the communities as well.
Well, I'm thinking that you set the tone. I sat on a great deal many commissions, and the commissions set the policy, which are implemented by the director and the staff. If a direction comes from the top that we need to focus on making department property an effective working part of the ecosystem, the patchwork quilt of ownership, then you get your goal of more wildlife and more opportunity, and we get our goal in maintaining a sustainable budget base for our government. That's what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brad. Yes.
And there again, this may help you, Kim, a little bit, but Brian brought up the fact that we had the department come and bring us dollar figures of what the dollar impact the department brought. And it was, what, roughly $500,000, right?
There was varying amounts.
Right, but I mean, it was roughly $500,000. And there again, Justin's in agriculture. He can, well, but some of our guys sat down really quickly, scratched it out. And though the department brought in $500,000 worth of economic impact, if you had the same ground in ranching and farming, it was north of $5 million. And there again, these rural counties, everything's more expensive to try and service these, and these guys are trying to stretch dollars and to make it work. And Brian's being really charitable when he says the impact, what it is, the PILT payments, lack thereof PILT payments, but they're still paying at the open spaces. There's no improvements, no nothing, and no personal property. And in agriculture, that's where you really get hammered. We get our property taxes are fairly cheap compared to residential areas, but we get hammered on personal property. And here a few years ago, we did this. If we sold our ranch to the department, what would they pay? What would we pay? And I don't have much for equipment because I just do a little hay and some logging. And I was four times what the department would pay. And there was guys that, what, Bruce, six, eight times that the private individuals. So that's where Brian and Justin get in the bite, is they still have all this infrastructure to try and keep. And then there again, in Assotin County, your land ownership's about 15% is what the department owns. So, I mean, when's enough enough? And that's, I think, where we're trying to push. But going forward, you need to be with these small rural counties. They are really getting a bind on for tax money coming in.
Well, and if I could add, Mr. Chair, the department through Steve Pizangara and his regional staff has worked really well with us. We have identified areas that we have in common. Our goals aren't the same, but we pick out the goals we have in common and figure out how we can accomplish them. One of the ways that we would like to see changes in department policy is we would like to, the money right now when, say, a property owner leases land back from the department for ag purposes of one sort or another. All that property goes to the state, goes in the department's general fund. We would like to see an attempt or a policy designed to direct investment of at least 50% of that money, at least 50%, back in the county. Right now, for example, if that farmer is leasing that land and there needs to be a new fence built, he can spend that money and turn that in lieu of rent. In the meantime, that money spent locally improves the economy, makes up for the personal property tax loss, things like that. So there are ways to refine what we're doing locally and have a greater impact. And if we could get more budget for the department to work on some of those things, that would help a lot.
Thank you. Yes, Commissioner.
Hi, I'm Commissioner Justin Dixon. I'm from Garfield County, born and raised 100 years with the family there, so the roots go deep. I come here today, I want to talk about a couple of issues. One of the things I want to talk about is for our future generations, my kids, grandkids, nephews, and nieces. I hunt, I fish, I don't have to take animals. I don't have to harvest animals. I love the outdoors, and that's what I want those kids to see in the future. And right now, I don't think we're doing the best that we can in the outdoors and in our local economy. I see these small towns struggle. The things that we can do to help, you know, the game department in Southeast Washington owns close to 70,000 acres. And the ground that's purchased isn't being utilized for grazing, logging. Weed control's not the best. When you're not doing that, your chance of fires and then the fences are torn down, and then the neighbor's responsibility to fix all of this, then the weeds transfer to the neighbor's property, and it's their control. And it puts a burden on them on many different levels. One of the things that I would like to stress on is just a little better land management on what you do own and access to that ground for the hikers. That you say that, and there's grass that's this tall. You can't walk in that. And if we could manage it somehow, it would be better for everybody, the wildlife. You ask the loggers in the mountains, where's the wildlife at? Right there with the equipment. It brings new growth. It brings everything to the economy. It brings workload. They buy fuel. They buy everything in the local economy when they're there. The animals, they're all on private property. They're in Cloverland eating the canola. They're on our private property in Peola. They're not on game department ground. How come? Because we manage our property a little bit. We graze the stuff that they like. I mean, we could seed some food plots in the canola or in the Cloverland area. We could do more of that and attract those animals. Not quite exact on acres, but you know, like 30 or 40 acre plots over there when the neighbors have 500 acre fields. There's areas that we could address and work on. It's pretty embarrassing when all the neighbors and all the private landowners have all the animals and they're upset with the game department. They don't want to let people hunt because they're mad at you, they're mad at us. And so what do we do now? We get into a big confrontation. I think there's things that we could work on, and communication is key to most of this. And we understand that there are requirements when you purchase property. But I think that there's things that we could do to enhance the opportunities for everybody. The elk herd that we're talking about is down 30% in Lick Creek this year. Why? I think we should address that issue. It's not been addressed 100%. We ask questions and we don't get answers right away from our biologists. I think there needs to be better communication lines between our biologists and staff in the area, and open this up somehow, some way, so we can communicate better. Maybe they could attend regular commission meetings in Garfield, Nisotan County quarterly. Give a little report, an email, something that would help us out. We're having to answer to the landowners, and then when we ask questions, we get stalled on answers, and it's tough to deal with. One of the issues with that communications is the wolves that we're introducing into the area. They are reportedly here and there, and when you ask questions, we don't get straight answers of where they're at. And one game department official will say one thing, and the other guy will say something else. I'd like a little bit better lines of communications in that aspect as well. Over to the fish side of things, Don Jackson and Jim Peterson, I sit on that board with those guys, and everything they say is true. More fish brings more people and helps the economy. And that's our request is help our economy. We're gonna blow up and dry away if we don't get some help of some sort. Like Commissioner Shin said, we'll back you. I don't think we need to buy more property. I think we need to manage it better, and then once it's managed better, people will say, hey, they're doing a good job. Why don't we sell them a little bit more ground now? One of the things that's come up in Southeast Washington is this Bennett LHP. And there's several landowners in these four counties that are extremely upset with the way this LHP was put together, handled, and has been run. I've met with Kevin Robinette and Steve Pizanger several different times. They've fielded phone calls from avid hunters and fishermen wondering why this is the way it is. You know, in that LHP, several of the guidelines that this board and commission has set were bypassed and overlooked, and they, in this LHP, for instance, there's one piece of ground that's landlocked that can't even be accessed unless you wade the Grand Round River and hike up the side of a mountain. Who's going to wade the river to get to access this piece of property? There's some very, very big concerns throughout Assotin, Garfield, and Columbia County on that LHP that need to be addressed. And there's several hundred thousand acres. I have signatures from landowners in all the counties, very upset at how it was handled. There's landowners that have allowed people to hunt for years and years and years. I have a list of over 40 first-time hunters on my property that I've let hunt. I've never received a big bull branched antler tag from Fish and Game. And somebody that doesn't allow people to hunt gets a branched antler tag, something's not right there. It upsets those people that are allowing the access. The wolves, back to communication, we need a direct line of communication between the department and elected officials in these communities where these wolves are coming into now. We have a lot of these people surviving on a few thousand acres of ground and a few hundred head of cattle, or even 40 head of cattle. And when they lose four or five in a year, and the time is coming, that's going to be devastating to those people. And it's part of our local economy that we need to help out. And I think we can do most of this through communication and step up and help everybody out. In Idaho, they've added a $5 fee for resident hunting licenses and a $10 fee for non-residents, and they've directed that money directly for elk damage, crop damage. They have two different pots. Maybe that's something that we could look out to help some of these landowners that in these counties that are losing crops. That would help the budget. I've asked several people in the communities, and they said, yes, we will. We'd pay $5 and $10. Maybe it'd gain more access. Maybe it'd help people out to gain access to hunt these properties. Questions, comments?
Okay. Yes.
I'm very impressed with all of you. I think you presented in a very articulate, calm, rational, cooperative way some of the main issues that you're interested in, and this is very, very helpful. On the fish issue, of course, what's going on in every single stream is not something that gets raised to the commission level. You know, we're involved in broader policies generally. So as you're talking about the fish issue, I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what caused that decline in the production of steelhead. Was it the lawsuits that we face? Was it just funding problems? Not sure. So I can't really respond. And I do know that it does take time to regenerate, to recover wild stocks, and we do have Endangered Species Act requirements to respond to. So I I hear what you're saying. I'm impressed with the way you delivered the message. I hope we can figure out some solutions. I'm glad that you're working with staff well. On the public lands management issue, I want to reassure you that the commission's been hearing this your message for many, many years. The message about lands, the needs for land management of the lands that we have, we heard about repeatedly. I mean, it's on our minds, it's on our radar screen, and has been a big, big concern for a long time. And I have to tell you that those concerns are shared on the west side as well. In the county that I live in, you hear the same message that DFW lands are not always managed as well as the privately owned lands. So we have been asking questions of staff about, do we have enough money to manage the lands we're buying? And the routine answer is, here's the estimate of what it's going to cost, and here's where it's going to come from. So we get a signal that, yes, we'll deal with it. But I think that there's still, as you say, issues. And if we could, and I love the way you're delivering this message, because it often is this conflict between the conservationists who are really representing a lot of very strong force in our state. Acquiring lands, making sure that it doesn't get developed and urbanized is a very popular notion. The day-to-day nitty-gritty of managing lands is just not as exciting to people in that community. But there's sympathy for it. So I could see that this is common ground. I hope we do come up with a way to get that funding source that acquires land to also consider ways to raise money for managing lands and working with local communities to make sure your economies are not hurt. I think this common ground is exciting, it's important, it's strategically important for us. So thanks for your message. This has really been great.
Bradley?
Yes.
There's a guy sitting in the back of the room that needs, and maybe ask him if he would come up, because he has served as the epitome of a partner. It's Monty Fujon. He is a district ranger over here at the Pomeroy Ranger District. And the way the department grounds are, they border a lot of Forest Service property. But Brian will first to say that Monty's been involved in our lands committee meeting. He absolutely, when it comes to local issues, listens and hears. And Monty, would you come up, hopefully say a few words? But no, this guy needs to be recognized because he is a partner.
Well, thanks a lot, Jay. Appreciate that. I did just send in a little letter to ask to have just a couple of minutes with you folks. I wanted to first, again, thank you for being willing to come over to this side of the state, where we're definitely tucked in the corner of Southeast Washington, and maybe some of you have never been to Sylvan County or Garfield County. So I hope in the next couple of days you get a different flavor for kind of what we're all about over here, and be able to see some of our landscapes and see some of the things that we do have to offer from a recreational standpoint and from a land management standpoint. What I was going to do was I was going to come up and just say that through the processes that we've evolved in here, I felt that this has been one of the greatest working relationships that I've ever been involved with. And I work for the federal government. I work for the Forest Service. I manage about 500,000 acres just adjacent to the department lands up on top of the mountain here. And so we work almost on a daily basis talking about issues, cross boundaries, those kinds of things. We've experienced some significant wildfires in the past 10 years with the school fire and the Columbia Complex fire and the Grizzly Bear fire. So there's three large wildfires. And we've been partners in restoration work and bringing elk herds back and adjusting land management practices, road closures, and those kinds of things for in all those situations. And I guess I'd just like to emphasize to you folks that we don't have maybe the population base here, but we definitely have the land base here. And I think, provide the opportunity for a lot of the things that you've been talking about, from recreation, hunting, land management practices, timber harvest jobs. We have that opportunity here, and I don't believe in Southeast Washington sometimes get the recognition that those opportunities are out there, and simply it's because of our smaller population base. But anybody from the east side, if they want to go get a trophy bull elk, the first place they talk about is the Blue Mountains. If they want to go out and experience a hike in the wilderness, the first place they think about is the Winnaha Toucanon. And so if they want to come fishing, the first thing they think about is the Clearwater or the Grand Ronde or the Snake River system. So all of those things are here. And as some of the previous speakers have mentioned, our numbers are getting smaller in terms of personnel and infrastructure. But I do believe that we work real closely together the best we can to help solve a lot of those issues that the public brings up. And surprisingly, I hear about from the public on a lot of different issues myself, and so I'm not unfamiliar with the things that they would deal with on a daily basis. So I guess all I'm asking for is you continue to support these folks. They've been extremely helpful to me and to the federal government in managing our acres, and we hope to continue that relationship in the future. We've got a great set of commissioners. I think that between Columbia and Garfield and Asotin counties, we also work together pretty well, I believe, and we get together quite often, talk about things, and we really appreciate that relationship. So I just wanted to say that we hope that they get your continued support in the future, and if there's any questions later on, feel free to give me a call or stop by, and I hope you have a great day tomorrow because you're going to see some neat stuff.
Thank you. Then, yes, sir.
I apologize. I got to add one more thing. I'm going to switch county commissioner hat off and switch hats for the Snake River Salmon Recovery Board, of which I'm a member of. And it's really important to know that most of the fish that we're all talking about are generated in this neck of the woods. Yet we fail to get our allocated share of fisheries up here. And I can't pass the opportunity up without pointing out the irony. The hatcheries are here. The fish start out here. Yet we do not get fair and equal access to fishery levels based on what you promised to do for us. Not you specifically, but you as a part of the coalition of Oregon and Washington. We would like to keep that as a top of mind awareness in your mind. We need more representation from this part of the state. We supply the resource. Give us our fair share back, please.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for bringing up that topic. It's a favorite of mine. This group have probably heard enough from me about it. And thank you for your serving on the Salmon Recovery Board. So I also serve on the Salmon Recovery Board. And I was one of the founding members of the endorsement board. So I've had a lot of exposure to the needs here in the Snake River Basin and this area of the Columbia River. And as you mentioned, a critical issue that's in the legislature right now is getting this endorsement board through. And I would appreciate you commissioners' efforts and any other groups that are represented here today. That's a very important funding source for the projects up here. and I know Steve Martin very well, and great job that you guys do down here in this region. And obviously you have a clear understanding of the importance of getting that bill passed through, and I would appreciate your support. And I'm doing what I can to contacting my legislators. So anyway, thanks so much for being here. I'll just say candidly that we kind of, you know, we have a debate internally on the commission. You know, it's a great deal of expense to bring commissioners and staff to meetings all over the state. But I think most of us agree it's important that we make the commission available to people throughout the state. And I really appreciate the comments and the welcoming that you've given us here today.
And let me summarize that all. Your comments were all spot on, and we need to hear them. And they do not fall on deaf ears. And your service and all of your various roles is very much about you. Do you yell that by Tammy? It's very much appreciated. I think it's a very complicated state, and as we all know, to manage resources at Fish and Wildlife. But the commissioners that you have that are on the commission from this side of the Cascades do a splendid job in you know, advocating for this part of the world. And just because we come from different parts of the state doesn't mean that we just represent that part either. I'm from the other cornerstone county, but we don't. It's not my role to advocate just for that part of the state. It's very difficult when we're trying to balance commercial, recreational, tribal, all of those issues. And the Columbia, as you know, from it's in your backyard, is one of those that poor fish that tries to get all the way up here, you know, or get all the way down there, is faced with a lot of challenges. So we can't do this by ourselves. We need the cooperation of the county commissions, of the legislature, and getting around the state is important for us. But we have been faced with severe budget cuts in the last few years, which really limited us to more isolation in Olympia. And that's not the way we should represent the state, but that's the fiscal reality of the budget that we are dealt with. So we want to get out more, and we will be. We were in Spokane just last time or the time before. So, I mean, it's getting better. But, again, we're all in this together. And the more that the less we point fingers and the more we try to shake hands, I think the stronger we will all be. So thank you all. And now we will return to the three-minute rule. If anybody doesn't like that, they can run for office, and then you can get all the time you want. So you get elected. I was asked once as we were going through, does that mean anybody that's elected? And normally it's been like county commissioners or state representatives, but, you know, at one time there was somebody that was elected to a very minor position, wanted their unlimited time too, and I don't think we've ever done that in our bylaws where we do draw the line. But again, calling up two at a time, Bruce Petty and Chad Johnson, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Director and Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for having us today. My name is Bruce Petty. I am a fifth generation grain farmer on Cloverland Ridge. You've heard about Cloverland some today. I'll try to fill you in as best I can in the time allotted. So it used to be, I'm going to say, and by used to be 15, 30 years ago, I've lived up there my whole life, but we would have elk occasionally, maybe 10 to 30. Maybe a big group had come through once, and maybe 75 would pass through. And it's no big deal. They move on. Didn't hurt anything. Neat to see them. So, you know, no harm, no foul. So maybe about 2011, if I remember right, all of a sudden, my neighbor calls me and says, have you been up to your upper place? There's some elk up there. Well, some elk turned out to be about 300 head, and they were right in the middle of my winter wheat. And there wasn't any amount of hollering or shooting at them or yelling or driving the four-wheeler that really made much difference. So at the time, we had no depredation tag system. So I called our game warden, and he said, because Anatone Ridge had a depredation tag system, and I said, I'd like to, you know, what can we do here? Well, there's nothing we can do. They're on Cloverland. They're not in Anatone. So I had just gotten myself a shiny new digital camera, so I took some pictures of my wheat, and I emailed it to him. He called me that night and says, you want a tag? I said, yeah, I do. So I took one, took a cow. Elk ran off. I felt better for about 15 minutes, and that was the next day the elk were back, and we were right back at it again. And they show up. They have been showing up ever since then. Around Thanksgiving, maybe a little later, and they will stay until about the end of February. This is not during the traditional hunting season. Some would ask, well, gosh, if you just let more elk hunters come, they'd chase the elk away for you and you wouldn't have them. Well, the problem is that's not when elk season is. We could have all the hunters in the world up there, and it wouldn't matter because that's not where the elk are at that particular time of year. So what the consequence has been, they really like canola. So if you would want to try to plant canola, they're going to find it, and they're going to pound it right into the ground. And the magazine you just got handed out is the cover of the Wheat Life from April of this year. That's a canola field. It was. Time's up.
You can finish your...
Okay, well, at any rate, things have been getting better slowly as far as fish and wildlife involvement and what they're trying to do to help. We had a meeting the other day. We've got some plans that we'd like to see happen. But it's going to be a long road, I'm afraid. And when Steve Pazanger comes to you with a plan, when that time comes, I would, on behalf of our ridge, appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. So what happened in 2011?
I wish I knew. I had no canola. I think the closest canola was about 7 miles down the road. So, at first, we were hoping it was maybe a 1 year, because I don't remember the winter being that bad, because they were out in the mud in our wheat. So it wasn't like it was really, really snowy. I honestly don't know. I wish I could tell you what they are attracted to, but they found wheat, and they must like it. And so they've decided to keep coming. So.
And I think... Chad's going to talk to it, and I think probably Dan Slay, but what these guys are talking about is the real deal, and they have conveyed a whole lot more patience with this situation than I would have. This picture that's on the front of the Wheat Life, I don't know, it was first part of April, very, very first part of April. I had to run over to Cloverland to go open up a road, and literally driving up the road at 50 mile an hour in a pickup, you could pick out which field the elk had found. It is just shocking is what it is. And this was a bad winter. There's no getting around that. But how many elk did you end up taking over there last year with basically no winter?
So that's a good point, and I failed to get to it. This winter, obviously, was an obnoxious one. And we had a lot of snow. And there was a lot of canola planted on the ridge. We took 22 elk with our depredation tags. Last winter, about as open a winter as I can ever remember, zero canola planted because it was so dry last fall and we really didn't have very big wheat either. We took 17. So statistically, I suppose you could say it was almost a toss-up. We took 5 more elk this year, being a nasty winter with lots of bait, if you will, although that's not why we plant canola for bait. So I think it's, go ahead.
I've got one other question. So this is an elk harvested canola field, not a
that
human
is, yes,
harvested.
Ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Canola. Okay.
So the little stems you see out there were wheat stubble. The farmer, Mark Green, seeded canola into it. The canola was about yay high. And that was what we got left with. What he got left with.
Right. And there again, normally Cloverland isn't the part of the world that I normally work, but it would have been about 2011 or 12. We went over there to do a job, and we had heard that the elk were up there, and we drove up the back. Dan Sangster and I happened to drive up the back road, and I mean, whose field would that be? Mark's?
Mark's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like you had a bunch of cattle bedded out there. I mean, we sat right there on the back road and counted north of 200 head of elk. So I think that's what that we need to keep beating the drum on. This isn't just a one-year problem. This has been an ongoing problem that really hasn't been addressed, but it needs to be addressed. And like you said, you had the meeting, what, a week or two ago?
Yep.
And hopefully some things are going to be addressed and have some solutions to them. But we've got to find a solution for these guys. There again, I've heard some figures around about what kind of a hit Mark has taken on this canola, and that's yet to be determined. But there again, used to farm, you'd have a crop of wheat grow up, hailstorm come through, hit it, knocks it down, then it'll sucker back. And your insurance company would always go, oh, you still got wheat out there. Yeah, but I didn't insure it suckered back and it has heads about like that, or your primary crop should have heads on it about like that. You're going to, yeah, it looks really good to the untrained eye. But, and then Mark tried to seed,
yep.
Reseed. Go ahead.
So this field, believe it or not, grew back. I wouldn't have given you 10 cents that it would have, but it tried. And if you look in the article, you'll see how the roots were black. And I think our wet spring that we've had nursed it along. If it had turned off dry like it normally does, I think it would have been a goner. But the wet weather's nursed it along. To look at it, it looks all right. Now, in the meantime, when it was still looking like this, Mark went out, seeded spring canola into it. And that's not cheap. That spring canola is expensive seed to buy. He's probably put another $40 an acre into it with just shoot from the hip guessing. And so it's out there. He's seeded into it. What he's going to get out of that, we don't know, because the winter stuff decided to sucker and take off on account of all the rain. So it remains to be seen. So,
thank you. And I want to just caution the commission that we are running behind time and we have a lot more public input yet to go through. So I don't want to stifle discussion, but I do have to be mindful of that. Yeah,
I was just curious, taking the 18 elk or the 22, or do you think that's the an effective way, or would you think the numbers need to go up, or is there some different solution you're really looking for?
You know, I wouldn't want to see that solution go away, because it does get them ran off some. However, I am finding, in my unofficial study, is that what we've done by doing that is we've made them incredibly nocturnal. So we don't even see them come. This is happening at night now. We might catch them first thing in the morning leaving. We might see them when they're coming in at night before it gets dark, maybe. When we're filling our tags, we're on the... It's not in broad daylight, put it that way. It's in the morning and it's at night, or close to night. I don't know if it's a solution, but on the other hand, I'd hate to see it go away.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dan Shalit, please, and Chad.
You want Dan first?
No, just to keep, keep two people up there at the same time.
Now I know how fast 3 minutes are. I just want to thank you real quick for giving me a chance to speak. As he did mention, the elk are nocturnal, but also what it has changed in the elk's habitat or habits is used to be when you'd go out there in the middle and you'd see 200-300 head and you'd shoot one or two, they'd all run. Now you can go out, muzzleloaders are filling their tags, you know, we'll try to work with them, let them fill their tags while you're standing there with a modern rifle, because you know, shoot, you can shoot for a mile or two, you know, fill your tag while they're standing there waiting for the elk to run close enough to them, you know. So you're sitting there waiting. You can skin three elk, and you'll have 200 that'll circle around. They'll watch you. They don't even care anymore to run, because this is becoming their home. You know, this is habit for them. Besides the crop, I happen to be the neighbor around the canola fields. I have a field that a few years ago, Bruce has hanging on a picture on his wall, school bus stopped because there was 50 head of elk in my field, and that was phenomenal. Kids were taking pictures. I mean, that was unheard of. So I've seen this go from, you know, nothing to 450, 500 head. Not only that, I still have fences. They're in horrible shape. The reason they're in horrible shape is because the first three or four jump them, the rest of them don't. I've had stretches 150 feet long. They've hit them so hard, they've left the steel posts and the wood posts are still fastened to the wire, and they strung them clear across County Road. Fish and Game doesn't repair fence. I've got a bill for estimate for 902 feet of fence repair, and that's running a measuring wheel only on the damaged stretches and raising it up on the good stretches for $3,136.70. Why do I have to cover that for a problem that isn't my problem? So while I was sitting here thinking of an analogy, the best way, you know, I'm seeing Seattle, Bellingham, Leavenworth, OMAC, you know, I know Jay doesn't have a neighbor right next door, but you know, however many of you live in town. So if I was your neighbor and my dog had run across the yard into your yard every night, chase your cat, cat's up on top of the fence, my dog's bouncing on your fence, knocking the fence over, tearing up your flowers, are you guys going to be acceptable to that? You know, it doesn't make good neighbors. To then say, well, my dog was laying here in the front yard here this morning, I don't know what the problem is. Because your elk, by daylight, they go right across the back road and they're laying on the benches in the sunshine.
So. Thank you. And Mr. Chetwood, yeah. Please. And Dan?
Thank you. Commission? Chairman, I'm Dan Schley, represent JBRS. We are landowners here in Soton County and Whitman County, and former owners of Smooth and Iron Ranch up Soton Creek. In 72, 73, we purchased the Black Ranch, and up until 2003, about 30 years, we ran livestock and farmed both on Smooth and Iron Ridge and also in the Cloverland area, Rock Pile, Stringtown, and George Creek. We managed the wildlife land that was adjacent to ours through a cooperative range management plan. The Forest Service was also involved with the Department of Wildlife and private landowners such as ourselves. And during those years, the elk coexisted comfortably on Smooth and Iron. And obviously, as you've heard from our neighbors, we have elk now in Cloverland. The biggest thing I can see as a current farmer in Cloverland and former cattleman on the Smoothing Iron and in the creeks and canyons adjacent to the Smoothing Iron area is the lack of grazing. I know you've heard it from other folks. I was up at the ranch yesterday checking on the hay crop adjacent to the buildings there on Smooth and Iron Ranch. JBRS has a small haying contract with the Department of Wildlife, and we also have a public grazing contract in Whitman County. So we're involved with the department. I am very happy with the local management and what they're trying to do to keep the elk on the smoothing iron and off to the southwest and the west of Cloverland. That's where they used to be. Now they've come down. The biggest thing, folks, that have changed is the lack of grazing. They, like I say, they coexisted with our cattle. The biggest thing as far as grazing, the fences are all gone. The department, after our sale to the department, there was grazing for a short while. And during that time, the fences were maintained. Some of the fences came out, which made grazing difficult. The department was trying to utilize the ridge tops to plant crops to hopefully attract the elk to stay. So the grazing was hopefully in the canyons and the rangeland where the elk wanted to be. This is the biggest change I've seen. I think if you folks could put some sort of range management back in that would utilize livestock to prepare that or to make that ground a little bit more palatable to the wildlife, I think the cat's out of the bag. You know, they've come down country. So whether or not we can get them to go back up country is going to be a major, major deal. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate your time.
Yes.
Dan, back in the day, because there again, about in the mid-70s, I was logging up in Dark Canyon, and what we always used to laugh about, 7 days or about 4 days after hunting season, the elk were back in your wheat field. But how many elk wintered up there at that time, would you guess?
I remember the elk passing through the meadows right above the house during the winter when there was lots of snow on the ground. I would say 350 to 550 head. They were there. They lived on the ranch in the winter. You know, they pastured the south slopes off of Smoothing Iron Ridge. They were back off the south slopes of Park Ridge and Cook Ridge. The elk were there. They lived with us. And, you know, when we initially got to the ranch in the early 70s, there were maybe, I don't know, 10, 25, 30 head that seemed to be there during the summer. But mostly, you know, we tried to push them off of the grain fields, which were on the top of the ridges. And so, you know, I wrote in my notes, we encouraged them to calve back in the canyons, back off into Wildlife and Forest Service. So the elk were there. They've been there. So if we could get them back there, that'd be great. They're there right now. I saw them yesterday. So
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Robert Howe, please. And Mr. Chetwood.
My name is Bill Chetwood. I live in Lewiston, Idaho. I'm concerned about a little different situation here. I'm concerned about the fish in the Lower Snake River. I'm concerned also about the process. The process is going and repeating and repeating, and we don't seem to be getting anything done. So we have to concern ourselves beyond that. I'd like to draw a little issue to the commercial navigation on the Lower Snake River that's considered in your decisions about bypassing the Lower Snake River dams. It's an important part of these discussions because when you evaluate the Lower Snake River dams, the economy of the transportation is definitely important. The expected claim by the Lower Snake River Dam supporters that freight volume on the waterways is continuing a steady climb of commerce on the Snake since the recession of 2008. This ignores at least two important facts. Freight transportation on the Lower Snake has been steady decline for 20 years, and none of the petroleum that contributed to the recent increase in total freight volume on the Lower Snake River was transported through the locks and four reservoirs that make up the Four Dam Snake Project. The Port of Pasco's terminal for petroleum is located on the Snake River near the river's mouth and well below Ice Harbor Dam, the lowest of the Snake River dams. The petroleum recorded in 2012-2015 did travel about 2 miles on the Snake, but according to the Corps' lock use, performance, and characteristics information available at its Navigation Statistics Center, none of that 2012-2015 freight passed through Ice Harbor locks. In short, none of the increases in freight volume of the Lower Snake River 2012 to 2015 traveled on any portion of the Snake River applicable to the discussions of the future of the Lower Snake River dams. Shippers of almost all products other than bulk grain and occasional wood pulp have abandoned the waterway, and the lack of upriver product, which is called deadheading, has increased the need for transportation subsidies, thus belying the general claim that barge transportation is the most cost-effective way to ship freight. This claim is further suspect by the increased interest in the unit trains used and supported for the transport of farm products. To conclude, the Army Corps of Engineers has categorized the Snake River as a waterway of negligible use, and that statistically proven status should be a major factor in the effort to restore the Lower Snake River. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, sir. Please, yes. And Bradley Johnson, please. And Mr. Ho.
Mr. Huff, thank you, and thank you guys for coming over. I'm going to make it real brief. I thought the county commissioners covered their very, very well. They had their information good. What I would like to focus on is your tour tomorrow, I understand, and please take note to the foliage that is building up on these areas where it very well could be pastured, and these contracts could be out. It would be a source of income for the game department and the state, and hopefully for the counties, and it would also help draw some of these elk back into the game management areas. There's no way that five or six people in the local game department is going to manage 70-some thousand acres of ground and do an adequate job. We all know that. But if you could bring some of these resources back, it's unfortunate that you won't be able to see all the area where the foliage is so tall. You remember here a few years ago, I think somewhere around 09 or 10, the Halsey Ranch burnt, and it was absolutely infernative, the heat that came out of that. I had my cat working on that. It was unbelievable. It's just amazing somebody didn't really get hurt on that project. And so we need to somehow get this land back into some kind of production. I understand that the elk and the deer are using it somewhat. You'll see deer tomorrow. You'll probably see elk on smoothing iron. But we do have a need for pasture, and some contracts could be let out. Thank you.
Wait, Bob. Bob. Thank you. With your backcountry horseman, I was hoping you were going to come and talk about a parking lot on Mountain View.
I could. It's been introduced for a parking area. Actually, they've got two planned for the long range for a parking area and some use for the Mountain View area. Our backcountry horseman group has been over there, even though I'm in Idaho, because it's just handier. Our next closest is in the Tri-Cities over here, so I belong in Idaho. We have been over there and done some fence projects. We plan on going over and helping on one. I've talked with Bob Dice about it. And we are planning on going over and doing some work on that one on top of Mountain View. I don't know if you'll get there tomorrow, but if you do, Jay can point it out. We are going to do some cooperative work with the State Game Department, and we do some work on smoothing iron as well. We take a group of 25 kids up there every year for a week-long horseback educational tour. It's fantastic to see the education and the learning and the joy the kids get out of riding. It's a big project. We really enjoy it, and we do appreciate the game department's cooperation.
All right. Well, that's great. Thank you. And Bradley?
No, I was pointing to Jay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm just, because I've been kind of beating this drum that we need to make the 4-0 a little more friendly for getting horse trailers in and out of there, because even on the Grouse Flat site, there's no place to park stock trailers but on the county road. And it sounds like we're going to get something going, maybe a parking lot on the Mountain View side, but we're buying some pretty big chunks of ground, and the access is fairly poor, right?
Actually, yeah, it is. And actually, we had a program set up to start that and get the parking area this spring, and the winter, as you know, continued until everybody got into the business scene. Hopefully this fall, we've still got that on our agenda to get over there and get that parking lot put in, and maybe with cooperation through the county and what have you, we can get that project done.
Great.
Thank you.
All right, Bradley and Sammy, next.
Commission members, Director Unsworth, really appreciate you coming down here. I could echo all the landowner and commissioner, county commissioner topics that have been addressed, and just hope that you'll take all these to heart. As I said, I've worked in southeastern Washington salmon recovery. I'm on the Snake River Salmon Recovery Board. I moved to Idaho because of the fishing and hunting in Idaho is a lot better than in Washington, specifically the spring Chinook fisheries. We've written letter after letter to the commission talking about the inequities of spring Chinook fishing. You see, this year Oregon and Washington harvested over 6,000 springers. We've harvested 30 in this area. You not only need to be good neighbors to landowners in these upper watersheds, you need to be a good neighbor to Idaho and the Nez Perce tribe. There's going to be some presentations today. I hope you'll ask lots of questions and get to understand that there's 10,000 fish needed for broodstock for spring Chinook. You guys provide zero. That is embarrassing in my mind. I can't understand why, as fisheries managers, the state of Washington wouldn't be helping with broodstock needs in the Snake and Salmon Rivers. The fishermen in Idaho have voluntarily giving up harvest in past years to increase broodstock. We're not seeing any fruits of that labor. You need to be a good neighbor. You need to be a co-manager in that. The local fisheries folks down here are great, but the policies that come out of Olympia and down in the lower Columbia really prohibit great fishing opportunities. I'd like to speak a little bit about what Dan Schley had to say. He was really kind of talking about different things, but when Dan sold you guys that place, I don't know how many people happened to be up there when Dan talked. And Dan stated exactly what was going to happen on the smoothing iron if management activities were removed. And it has happened. It is maybe past a tipping, well, it's past the tipping point. And hopefully you will work with this lands committee that Commissioner Shin and Jay and people are on, and these local landowners. They're compassionate about what they're doing. Shooting cow elk isn't going to save them or stop the problem. You've got to get back onto the smoothing iron, get grazing back there, and more importantly, get farming activities back there, like Dan and his family had done for previous years. And none of these things that I'm presenting to you have an easy solution. I understand there's a lot of politics involved in it, but I'm starting to look at Jim and go, he moved from Idaho to Washington. Do I need to move back to Washington? So thank you for your time and good luck.
All right, thank you. Sam Ledgerwood.
Hi, I'm Sammy Ledgerwood Cherrier. I'm a fourth generation rancher in Garfield County. We have a forest allotment in the Blue Mountains in the Umatilla National, and we used to lease the Slay Ranch. We were currently leasees when the land was purchased by the Game Department. We have a fairly sizable cattle operation. We represent the top 1% as far as in the state of Washington. So a fairly sizable cattle operation. The good neighbors thing that I wanted to talk about has pretty well been touched. But I wanted to, again, reinstate that keep the wildlife on the land that was on the land when you purchased it, and that's why you purchased it. So that's pretty well been covered. I guess I'm going to kind of switch subjects a little bit and touch on the wolves a little bit. That has been a major impact to the cattle industry, more in the northern part of the state than it has in ours. But we have them. They're here. We understand they're here to stay. I attended a deal with Jay in Montana about how to live with them, how to coexist with them. And I think that we as cattle ranchers, we need to work towards that, but we also need your cooperation as far as getting some more collars on them so we know where they are, so that we know how to keep cattle out of denning areas. If we have some knowledge, we can prevent some of the depredations that are going to happen. And we also need the continued compensation program through the working agreements that you guys have presented. Our family has had that. I personally have had that. I have my own separate cows from the family ranch. We've had that, and it's been helpful to try to offset some of our additional cost. Our ranch has hired an additional person to make sure that we can keep our feet on the ground and try to know where the wolves are, know when they're in our cows, find the animals that have been depredated on. We've also, through that working agreement, we've also made a big effort to remove dead animals. It's not always easy. We spent 2 hours with two of us to get a dead cow this last week so that she wasn't left out there where now the wolves have got young pups, and we don't want them eating our cattle. I know you don't want them eating our cattle, but that's something that we need to continue. I've heard talk about there's not going to be that funding for those working agreements. If there's anything you can do to keep that funding there, to continue to work with us, that's something that is very important to us. When Jay and I were in Montana, we talked to the local ranchers there as far as what is something that has happened to make it easier to live with them, and the hunting season is something that they said has worked very well for them. And if I remember right, I don't remember the exact numbers, but the first year of the hunting season, there was a limit on how many wolves could be killed. And they met that in that first year. If I remember right, in the second year, they didn't even get close to the quota. The wolves became afraid of humans. And right now, we have nothing to make them afraid of us, nothing to make them afraid of the human contact. Similar to the elk, they're not afraid of you until you start doing something. So I think that's something that if we can look forward to that in the future, look forward to that managing. I realize the being listed and federally listed and all of that plays into that a big part, but I think that's something that if we can look at our neighboring states to see how that's helped them be able to manage the problem that they can cause for us. So,
yes.
Just like to thank Sammy for coming up here, and the fact that some of those things that you heard about in Montana, it looks like you're applying them. That's just to be applauded. And you know, she took to heart the two things that we heard about over there: sanitation and human presence is so important. So I'm glad that you're doing those things. And I think the commission has to think through, especially what she said about hunting, because eventually the Wolf Advisory Group will be taking on that discussion. And there's more things. Well, it won't be called hunting, it'll be called management. But the idea of what do we do with an increasing population, when we have a recovered population, then some pressure might need to be brought to bear to where, and it can affect other things, just like she's saying. You know, it can put a little fear into the animals to where it's not as hard for ranchers to keep up with that situation and maybe avoid some of the problems that you get into when it's just wolves and livestock without much pressure being put on. So anyway, good to see you again, and thanks for what you're doing.
And Stan Bailey, please, and Mr. Ledgewood.
I'm Sam Ledgewood. Like my daughter stated, I'm, you know, proud father of Sammy, in case you want to know. But our forest allotment borders the 4-0 cattle company on the south side and the smoothing iron on the north side. So I'm very interactive with the department lands and with the department personnel. Challenging at times, for sure. We have different goals and different ways of going about goals, but I hope we can always continue to communicate. The land purchases are a big factor for me. We've seen the deterioration of our local economy, our tax base. As landowners, our taxes have gone up to compensate for the lack of taxes, the difference in the taxes paid when they were in private versus department owned.
This is a statewide issue. And like I stated, you know, I'm really interactive with the department lands. I was actively leasing, the ranch was, you know, Sammy included, actively leasing the lands from Mr. Slay when they purchased the land. And when you're leasing pasture land, and hopefully some of you will get to see, but these canyons are tough. Managing them is tough. We worked at it. We were managing it. For me to go back and look at it now, it's hard. It's very hard because it's the fuel load is very high. I know we got at least one Blue Mountain Fire District person in the room to fight fire in them canyons. DNR does your fire suppression. They're so tough. The fuel load is so high. It's pretty much suicidal to go in there. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, no matter how trained or how much equipment you have. It's really dangerous, especially on years like this with the fuel load we have. Our commissioners did a wonderful job. I am a member of the Lands Committee also, so I interact with them that way. The one thing that was missed maybe is SEPA. I was part of the pilot project when they did the Smooth and Iron and Pentler Creek grazing things. If you remember right, those of you that were here with Western Watersheds and the lawsuit, and SEPA is what got us in the Pentler Creek area. So in the meeting, the land planning meeting that we had last week locally here for the Blue Mountain region, I tried to stress that we need to put in the plans to do SEPA, because without doing SEPA, we can't do these actions. You know, you can say less graze or less burn or less harvest the trees, but if you don't do SEPA, you can't do it. So, you know, depending on the history of the land, I understand that, but at the same time, that needs to be part of the plans and allocate the money or the time or the personnel or whatever it takes to get that done, because the action can't be taken without the SEPA part. So, like I said, I've been a member of the CAG, member of the Lands Committee. I think that the cooperation with the local landowners is very important to your elk and your habitat. You know, we have a sizable ranch. I've worked with Brad Johnson on fisheries on the Alpaui Creek. It's not rocket science. You build the habitat and they will come. We've seen it. So, thank you.
Thank you, sir. And Jason Schultz, please. And Brent.
Yeah. First, I'd like to say thank you for you guys letting us meet and talk. I'm just going to speak real quick as a concerned, I guess you'd call boots on the ground sportsman. Real quick, I'm 64. I bought a Washington fishing and hunting license since I was 12. I have 60 acres up the Snake River. I know a little bit about the elk and situation. I feel for them guys. My grandfather, the Fordyce Trails were named after my grandfather. He sheep ranched up Lick Creek. So I followed this herd a little bit. But first, I got three things, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good, I'd like to let you guys know, speaking as a sportsman, two things. I think our deer situation is really good. You hit this nail right on the head. The three-pointer better has been a success. You'll hear very few people gripe about it. We have trophy animals. The second good is I've taken four of my six grandchildren through Washington Hunter's Ed in the last 7 years. And in our county, we got a tremendous group. They do a really good job. I'd like to thank them and thank you guys. I hope we keep our Hunter Ed program going good. Now the bad, I'm not going to go in real deep on the elk situation, but you've heard it from the guys on the Cloverland, the farmers. I know all of them. I've hunted up there. I'd like you to look at this situation a little bit. Mr. Petty talked about in 2 years they had 22 depredation tags, 1 year, 17 the other. This year in the Lick Creek unit, you're giving out three cow tags. I don't get it. That's insane. I hunt every year on the Smooth and Iron Ridge, and I can still make it from the road to the top. You'll sit there, and every year you can watch that herd, the same 200 that are invading these guys, leave Lick Creek, go into the Harlow Ridge, into Cloverland. Three tags. I got a novel idea. Hey, let's maybe try give us boots on the ground, guys. That unit could easily handle 50 cow tags for a couple years, easily, I think. That'd help a little bit. And I wish you'd kind of maybe look at that. That's pretty much it.
Thank you. We're going to have a briefing on Hunter Ed right at in this morning, so you might want to.
Sure. It's a good deal.
Hunter Ed is so important, and that because the number of kids that are exposed to that, like when we were young, it was a lot more. But it's just, you know, for all of the reasons that we know. Thank you, and you are the final.
Can you hear me? My name's Jason Schultz. I'm a Clarkston resident. And I've been a professional fishing guide all my adult life. I run a small business we call Hell's Canyon Sport Fishing here in the Lewis and Clark Valley. And I wanted to express my concern about the condition of the spring Chinook run. Our business isn't a hobby job. This is how we support our family. And I have four other guys that work with me as we provide guided fishing opportunities for the public. And none of us are going to receive a decent paycheck this month because the fishing opportunity for the spring Chinook that we were relying on just basically folded up on us last minute. And I'm particularly concerned with the way things are managed between the three states, Washington, Oregon, Idaho. And it seems like every year I sit in these meetings and it's always the same thing. Geez, guys, you know, we didn't get as many fish back as we was hoping to. And you're kind of at the end of the line, and now there's just not going to be enough to go around. So what we're going to do is we're going to break this up into smaller pieces of the pie, and we're just going to give this little section of the river this amount of fish and this section of the river this amount of fish. We're going to try to make the best of what we got. And what I'd like to see, considering I've monitored the condition of these fisheries probably as well or more than anybody in this room. I've done this all my adult life. I've been out there every spring Chinook season that's been open since they've had seasons here since the mid-90s. And I would like to see some forward thinking. I don't see anything getting better the way things are going. And it's been said today, you know, yeah, it's a difficult situation where you have three different states that are all looking out for their interests. You have tribes involved. You have conditions you can't control, ocean conditions and whatnot. But there are some things that can be controlled. We have known problems like the sea lion problem at the mouth of Columbia. We have a huge supply and demand issue. You guys have, the state of Washington has a resource here that is very, very popular. Anybody that's been to Clarkston and Lewiston and seen the amount of fishing that takes place just right in the confluence area, middle of May, it just brings all kinds of life to the valley. Tons of people come to the area to fish. People love it. People want spring Chinook. And I provide a business which, you know, provides my livelihood, but I also work with the public. I have tons of people that are so disappointed because they've planned their time to come down and fish and their family, and they have plane tickets. And it is so hard to tell these people, look, guys, this isn't going to happen. They say, well, what do you mean? No, we've been planning this for 6 months. I said, I know. I said, I'm going to have to send your money back because it's not open. The fish aren't here. Idaho produces a lot of spring Chinook. And one of the big problems that they have, from what their managers have told me, is a water source issue at Dorshak Dam. And I keep saying, come on, guys. Find the money. Fix this problem. And my question to you guys is, where's Washington's support on hatchery fish production. You keep hearing issues about coming up with money for these projects, but you get the right people and the right way of thinking, it can be done. The money is there. It can be overcome. And thanks for just listening to my concern. And just know I wanted you to hear from someone that this directly affects financially and personally. Thank you.
Thank you. It's very important for us to hear that. We appreciate your taking the time to do that.
Yeah.
Well, that will bring an end to the open public input. Again, thank you all. This is, as I like to say sometimes, this is how it should work. We come, we have to listen, we have to hear. And believe me, we share all of your concerns, and we're trying to find ways that we can lessen or alleviate or eliminate those. And Steve, all of the kudos I heard from you, congratulations. Normally we're used to more people saying bad things. So. yeah, right. But there's still email you can do. So. Okay, I almost hate to bring this next subject up right now, but